In early 1984, Adolph Coors heard about Sunflow from a friend who served as informal business advisor. The friend says he'd been introduced to Kabus and Sunflow by a consultant Kabus had retained to help raise money. Coors looked into the firm and apparently liked what he saw. In July, He Lives Incorporated, a new firm founded and controlled by Adolph Coors, entered into an agreement with Sunflow in which He Lives agreed to purchase a $100,000 to $150,000 dehydrator from Sunflow and lease it back to Sunflow. The dehydrator would then be shipped to Jamaica for a pilot dehydration project there. Coors also acquired 1,834 shares of Sunflow stock, about 2% of the firm's total. The dehydrator was built and tested, but never made it to Jamaica. Kabus did, though. He returned with an agreement to start two pilot dehydration plants with a Jamaican company. Kabus said he made the trip at the suggestion of AID officials, that's the Agency for International Development officials, he met at a USDA-sponsored trade show in Atlanta in 1983. Once again, Kabus had attracted a sizable chunk of money from someone with deep pockets. This time, he'd not only gotten the Coors money, but the Coors name, a connection that led straight to the White House. Closer to home, Coors also helped Kabus to reestablish contact with Armstrong. That's former California Senator Robert Armstrong, by the way. Kabus was grateful. Quote, "Your confidence has made this company," he wrote in one letter to Coors. "With your credibility and entrees, you have opened doors and minds to what we both believe is destiny," unquote. Coors referred questions about his Sunflow investment to his lawyer, who in turn refused comment. So Adolph Coors IV, a member of the Coors family, though not apparently involved in the day-to-day operations of the brewery, apparently an individual very much involved with the born-again or right-wing Christian movement. I assume that's what He Lives Incorporated referred to. But it is worth noting again that we find the Coors name and Coors money involved with Sunflow, as we have with so many other reactionary political institutions and movements in the past 10 years. Skipping down once again in this particular article, we now find, again, in indications, nothing firm, but indications that the Sunflow drug smuggling operations may have been connected not only to CIA, but to specifically the Contra support effort. The drug dealing under Sunflow's cover may not have been restricted to Colorado. A federal agent stationed in Costa Rica in 1986 says a contact told him Sunflow was involved in the drug business there. The firm used a greenhouse a few miles outside San Jose as a cover, the contact told the agent. The agent says he also overheard a conversation between Costa Rica-based DEA agents in which they referred to a shipment of flowers headed for Sunflow in Colorado. From their talk, it was clear the cargo was cocaine and that the DEA agents had no intention of stopping the shipment. There are also signs Sunflow may have been part of the drug smuggling undertaken on behalf of the Nicaraguan rebels. A pilot who flew two cargoes of cocaine, whose sales proceeds went to the rebels, says he was told by a source in Jamaica that Sunflow was used as a cover for cocaine trafficking. He also says he was told by the head of a Pennsylvania air transport company that the firm was helping provide Sunflow with aircraft modified for long-distance flights, modifications that allowed those planes to be used by drug smugglers. Federal officials later charged people affiliated with the Pennsylvania firm with smuggling tons of cocaine into the U.S. from Colombia through Jamaica and the Bahamas. The head of the firm and several others were convicted. In addition, a pilot who flew drugs has told a Colorado associate he helped Marcella arrange international drug deals at about the same time Marcella became a Sunflow investor. He also said that years earlier, he was smuggling drugs into the U.S. from a Costa Rican airport controlled by John Hull, an American who helped the Nicaraguan rebels and has been linked by other dealers to drug trafficking. In her book, Out of Control, former CBS producer Leslie Coburn details how CIA officials linked up with drug dealers and others, including Hull, to raise money from drug deals for the Nicaraguan rebels after Congress cut off government funding. Kabus denies purchasing or selling drugs anywhere in Colorado after 1979, much less Central America. He says he has no indication anyone ever used Sunflow as a cover for drug trafficking. But he also won't comment on whether he suspected any of the others affiliated with Sunflow might be dealing drugs. Quote, "I suspect everyone sometimes," he says, "but I don't want to speculate. It's not my job," unquote. Kabus says he told all his investors that he was determined to keep Sunflow out of the drug business. He required them to complete detailed questionnaires before he allowed them to invest. "I did this company completely on the straight," he says. But sometime during the first half of 1984, Boulder area drug dealers began urging their friends to get involved with Sunflow. Cabus was claiming he'd lined up yet another powerful new friend, Neil Bush. Neil is the third child of George and Barbara Bush. He moved to Denver in 1980 to get into the oil business. In 1983, he co-founded JNB Exploration, an oil and gas venture. Until recently, Neil kept a low public profile. His only mention in national news stories came in 1981 when he had a dinner appointment with Scott Hinckley on the day Scott's younger brother John shot Reagan. The engagement was canceled. Last month, Neil became a twice-weekly commentator on KMGH Channel 7. The tenant at the Boulder farm where Sunflow's demonstration dehydrator was stored, who'd also been convicted of drug charges, has told a Boulder associate that Neil was one of the people who trooped up to the house to see the dehydrator in action. Soon thereafter, drug dealers say, Cabus began claiming Neil Bush was going to invest in Sunflow. Bush's kid is in my hip pocket, they quoted Cabus as saying, according to a source with contacts in the Boulder drug community. Anyone else who bought in would have a piece of the successful and soon-to-be-profitable company, Cabus promised. According to another contact who'd heard these reports, Cabus implied that drug deals conducted under Sunflow's cover would be free from federal scrutiny because of George and Neil Bush's connection to the company. One more time, that last sentence. According to another contact who heard these reports, Cabus implied that drug deals conducted under Sunflow's cover would be free from federal scrutiny because of George and Neil Bush's connection to the company. Cabus told Westward he's never heard of Neil Bush and has no idea who he is. Neil Bush says he doesn't know who Cabus is either. He says he never heard of Sunflow and never visited any Boulder farm to see a dehydrator demonstrated. Even though Cabus repeatedly used the Bush name to promote his company, there's no evidence Neil Bush ever invested in Sunflow. But there is evidence the Sunflow investigation wasn't pursued aggressively. That's where Neil Bush's name comes up again. One day in 1984, a high-ranking federal law enforcement officer scheduled a meeting with Robert Miller, the chief federal prosecutor for Colorado. The officer wanted to relay information he'd received concerning connections between Sunflow and the Bush and Coors families. At the time, Sunflow was under investigation by Thomas and other members of the Mountain States Drug Task Force operating under Miller's direction. Miller was told that a witness federal agents wanted to interview in connection with the Sunflow probe was reluctant to talk because he'd been told by Cabus or others connected to the company that Sunflow was protected by George Bush, Joe Coors, and or members of their families. The witness didn't want to risk retaliation if the investigation was already compromised. Miller also was told that Coors had invested about $100,000 in Sunflow, that Neil Bush had established ties with businessmen probably involved in illegal activities, and that it was likely he was connected to Cabus and Sunflow as well. Miller took this information in stride. You could tell he wasn't overly moved by it, the officer recalls. I had the feeling he was saying, okay, you've done your civic duty, now get the hell out. Miller told the officer he'd have an agent pursue the matter. On his way out of Miller's office, the officer says he noticed a message on the secretary's desk. It was from Neil Bush, a reminder for Miller of their dinner engagement that evening. You know Neil Bush? The officer asked. Sure, Miller replied, I know him well. Miller said he socialized with the younger Bush regularly and considered him a good friend. They'd go hunting together every now and then, he'd said. The officer says he was surprised Miller never suggested there might be a conflict between his friendship with Bush and the investigation involving Cabus and Sunflow. His surprise turned to suspicion when no DEA agent or federal prosecutor ever contacted him or his source. It seemed his incredible charges were being intentionally ignored, he says. The federal probe of Sunflow Associates continued, eventually resulting in the indictments of Marcella and Murch, among others. By the way, Murch, as well as the aforementioned Tuft, among the relatively minor associates of Marcello Cabus. William Marcello is one of his major associates, one of his L.A. links. But the reluctant witness never did testify, and there haven't been any new charges since 1984. Although he became the point person in the investigations, Thomas never received some of the information available on Sunflow. He was never told Adolph Coors was a Sunflow investor, Thomas says, although Coors' investment is clearly listed on Sunflow records. Nor did Thomas know about the report delivered to Miller that George Bush was connected to the firm, and that Neil Bush probably was, too. Miller never told him about that, Thomas says, quote, If there was relevant information, I would have expected someone to tell me about it, Thomas says. It's difficult to determine how information about the connections between Cabus, Sunflow, Coors, and George and Neil Bush would have affected his investigation, Thomas says. At the very least, he would have been more alert to signs of political interference. But by accident or design, Thomas was kept in the dark. The investigation was seriously handicapped in other ways, too. No DEA or FBI agent talked to the Sunflow executives who helped run the firm, then became disenchanted with Cabus and left the company. If they'd been interviewed, they might have provided evidence of illegal activities. Thomas says he considered interviewing Sunflow executives, but by the time the company emerged as a focus of the probe, he'd already developed doubts about whether it was worth pursuing the matter. The legal question over the state wiretap was never resolved, and the DEA wasn't cooperating. There were other important cases that needed his attention. I had 10,000 leads, but no gripper, he says. I got tired of the case, and I wasn't sure I could put it together. Nevertheless, Thomas says he was convinced and still is that Sunflow wasn't created to market a dehydrator. I never believed it was a legitimate business, he says. I always believed it was a drug front. And again, the fact that the fellow Robert Miller, who was head of the Mountain States Drug Task Force, which was charged with investigating the Sunflow case, and which received information linking both Joe, not just Adolph Coors, this is where the confusion arose in my mind, the information that Joe Coors may have even been involved in this. The same individual, unnamed informant, provided information that George and Neil Bush were connected to this. Interestingly enough, Neil Bush was not only friendly with Robert Miller, but the agent who was helping to communicate with Robert Miller noticed that Neil Bush was scheduled to have dinner with Robert Miller on that, or very shortly. The name Arthur Fletcher is an interesting one, too. That recall, that's the black Republican who accompanied Bush on the diplomatic tour to Africa in 1982. He was one of the people first involved in helping to promote Sunflow, and his name has cropped up in the news recently. Specifically now, reading from the San Francisco Chronicle from Saturday, February 24th of 1990. This is an AP story, Dateline Washington, and headlined, Bush chooses GOP moderate to run embattled rights panel, and it reads in part as follows. George Bush yesterday selected Arthur Fletcher, a black Republican moderate who worked for some years in Northern California, to be chairman of the Civil Rights Commission. Fletcher's first assignment will be to reinvigorate the embattled commission, said Bush spokesman Marlon Fitzwater, adding, quote, we think they can do a better job, unquote. Fletcher, 65, runs a consulting business in Washington. An early black supporter of Bush's, he has served in three previous GOP administrations. Bush sought to give him the post nearly a year ago, but the panel chairman, William Allen, at the time declined to resign, although he has since done so. The commission has been under mounting criticism from civil rights groups and Congress, stemming from a series of positions it adopted during the Reagan administration, including opposition to affirmative action programs. Skipping down in the article, Fletcher, a prominent Republican in the District of Columbia, ran for mayor against current mayor Marion Barry. Well, it's interesting here, too, because apparently the Bush-Fletcher relationship is ongoing. And it's also interesting, too, that Arthur Fletcher had challenged Marion Barry for the mayor, for the mayoralty position of Washington, D.C. Now, of course, Marion Barry has recently come into national focus because he was busted for possessing and smoking crack cocaine, and certainly that's not an activity I sanction. The thing that's interesting here, though, is the disparity between the enormous national media spotlight turned on Marion Barry and the relative lack of publicity, and in fact, perhaps, it appears the cover-up of the Sunflow case. Apparently some of the heavy names involved have dissuaded some of the people involved with looking into the Sunflow case from looking into it very fully. Whether or not, as there are possible indications, the Sunflow case turns out to connect up with Contra-related drug smuggling activities, certainly it's an interesting case, and I think there certainly appear to be many more questions to be answered than have been answered so far. I think it's worth noting the glare of media attention on Marion Barry and the relative lack of scrutiny given the Sunflow case and, in turn, Arthur Fletcher. I'm not in any way claiming Arthur Fletcher is guilty of drug smuggling activities or other criminal activity, but at the same time, I'm not at all satisfied by the disclaimers given by all of the principal figures involved, including Arthur Fletcher, and I think there are some serious questions for Arthur Fletcher and others to answer about their involvement with the Sunflow case. And it's tragic that the national media do not pursue the Arthur Fletcher Sunflow connections as avidly as they pursue the Marion Barry connections. Perhaps ultimately we'd find that Arthur Fletcher may have been connected with the supply side end of this particular economic situation, whereas Marion Barry was involved with use. Food for thought, grounds for further research. One of the things that's so interesting to me about the Sunflow case and why I've gone into it, and why I think there are some questions that need to be asked about Neil Bush, about the possibilities between of connections between Sunflow and some of the Contra-related drug smuggling activities, is that, again, the questions of possible relationship between the CIA and the Silverado savings and loan failure. Neil Bush has been implicated in the failure of the Silverado savings and loan. I think there are some very serious questions to be answered concerning the possibilities of a Silverado-CIA-Sunflow connection. Not something, obviously, that we can state ipso facto at this time. At this point, though, it is only a possibility, but it certainly seems a reasonable possibility and one that needs to be investigated. We're going to take a short musical break now, and then we're going to come back with some interesting information about General Noriega, about some of the connections between some of these activities and General Noriega, the drug smuggling case, and, again, the CIA-SNL case. And looks to me, just from the way the time is going, that we're going to have to resume this particular case again either next week or the following week, depending on whether we go again with archives next week. But I don't think, given the material that we've got left, that we're going to be able to finish up this particular archive show this evening. We're going to take a short musical break, and then we will come back with more information. All righty, good evening. Welcome back once again to the prepared portion of One Step Beyond. And indeed, tonight is going to be all prepared. I think next week we will conclude the broadcast for this evening, because I'm definitely not going to be able to get all of the archival material into the archives tonight. So we will resume, we will conclude the CIA and the SNL scandal and some of its related connections next week. Now, one of the reasons why I'm asking the question about the possibility of involvement of the Silverado savings and loan with the CIA, and in turn with Neil Bush and that whole scandal, that is to say the CIA-SNL connection and the failure of Silverado savings and loan, and that would appear to be implicated, to be the implication of the February 4th, 1990 Houston Post article. Again, I'm asking the question about the possibility of relationships between Neil Bush, Silverado savings and loan, the failure of the Silverado savings and loan, and the CIA connection to the SNL scandal. In turn, I wonder, I'm not saying there are connections, but I wonder, on the basis of the information that we have, whether those in turn might connect up in some way with both the Sunflow case, in which Neil Bush's name is implicated. Of course, he claims innocence, everybody else claims innocence, but equally, obviously, the investigation has been less than vigorous. There are also indications, of course, that the Sunflow case may connect up with Contra-related drug smuggling activities. That's why I asked the question about these two Colorado cases, the Silverado savings and loan case and the Sunflow case out of Boulder, because the Sunflow case does appear to involve some of the major Republican potentates in Colorado, and it also touches on the Bushes, also obviously touches on Mr. Arthur Fletcher. Now, the Colorado drug smuggling connection is a very, very big one at this particular moment, and it's looming also in the forthcoming trial of General Noriega in Panama, and as we looked at, in the December Surprise 89, my analysis of some of the factors involved in the U.S. invasion of Panama, that invasion was connected in no small way to the cover-up of the Iran-Contra scandal. That was by no means the only or even the primary motivation, but it was one of the major factors. Reading now from the Los Angeles Times of Thursday, March 15th of 1990, we begin to see just why the Colorado connection looms so very, very large, and we're going to now explore how this may connect up with the situation vis-a-vis General Noriega, and eventually we're going to come around to, you guessed it, drug tug Lenvest. Again, front page, Los Angeles Times, Thursday, March 15th, 1990. This is an L.A. Times story, Dateline, Washington headlined, Drug Runner's Testimony Key to Noriega Case. Prosecutors in the Miami drug trafficking case against Manuel A. Noriega are counting on important testimony from a secret witness who has spent more than a decade alternating between drug smuggling and undercover work for U.S. law enforcement and intelligence agencies. Alfredo Sanchez, who risked his life developing a major case against Colombian cocaine dealers, appears able to bolster the government's central contention that Noriega had extensive dealings with the drug lords of the Medellin cartel. So far, Sanchez is a mystery figure in the Noriega case. His name does not appear in court documents in the case, and defense attorneys said they had never heard his name in connection with the case. Prosecutors in Miami refused to acknowledge his involvement in the case, presumably out of concern for his safety. Weighing the value of Sanchez's testimony is difficult because of the secrecy, and most records naming him have been placed under court seal. But records contained in a related case file in Denver portray Sanchez as a highly paid government informant who met with drug barons in Colombia on a dangerous undercover mission. Those last two sentences again. Weighing the value of Sanchez's testimony is difficult because of the secrecy, and most records naming him have been placed under court seal. But records contained in a related case file in Denver portray Sanchez as a highly paid government informant who met with drug barons in Colombia on a dangerous undercover mission. A source who has had extensive conversations with Sanchez said the informant also met personally with Noriega while working for the Drug Enforcement Administration. Court records provide no hint of a direct meeting with Noriega, and efforts to confirm that assertion were unsuccessful. Records available in Denver and interviews, however, do provide the outline of Sanchez's key role in the Noriega case, as well as a vivid portrait of his life as an undercover informant for the DEA, the military's Defense Intelligence Agency, and even the super-secret National Security Agency. Noriega is charged in federal indictments in Miami and Tampa with protecting drug traffickers and facilitating money laundering. The Miami case is scheduled to go to trial first in November. Much more is at stake than Noriega's own fate. A conviction would help the Bush administration justify its December invasion of Panama, which succeeded in its goal of forcing Noriega out of Panama to face trial in the United States. A source familiar with the case against Noriega in Miami described Sanchez as, quote, a very valuable witness, unquote, with access to sensitive information about Noriega's relationship with Colombian drug lords. That assessment was supported at Sanchez's sentencing on drug charges in June of 1988 by Richard D. Gregory, G-R-E-G-O-R-I-E, the former assistant U.S. attorney who put together the Noriega indictment in Miami. Sanchez had pleaded guilty to importing 80 kilograms of cocaine from Colombia to Miami, and Gregory appeared at the sentencing to describe Sanchez's cooperation in a bid for leniency. This particular defendant, Your Honor, is providing information and other evidence which will allow us to explain a great deal of the conspiracy, which was sort of a blank spot in the Noriega case, Gregory said. There are a number of facts which were essentially not clear because there was no testimony. This particular defendant can now provide the information which will fill in those blanks, unquote. Gregory offered no details of Sanchez's evidence, but he indicated that it involved Noriega and Colombian drug barons Pablo Escobar and Jorge Ochoa, two of Noriega's co-defendants in the Miami case. The indictment charges that Noriega provided a haven for Escobar and Ochoa after they arranged the murder of Colombia's justice minister in 1984, and that he protected their drug shipments through Panama. He said Sanchez would be called as a witness in the event of a Noriega trial, which seemed a remote possibility in 1988. He expressed concern over Sanchez's safety as a result of his cooperation with the government. The danger stemmed not only from Sanchez's role in the Noriega investigation. Sanchez had also worked for the DEA in putting together a case in which Escobar and five others were indicted for smuggling $80 million to $90 million worth of cocaine into Colorado for distribution in Los Angeles, according to testimony at the sentencing. He put his neck out a mile long, said Matthew Mayer, a DEA agent in Denver, describing Sanchez's daring role in the Colorado investigation. These people don't quibble when it comes to retribution, unquote. To protect Sanchez's identity at the sentencing, U.S. District Judge Stanley Marcus took the unusual step of ensuring that no one was in the courtroom who was not involved officially in the case. The transcript of the proceeding was sealed in Miami, but a copy was obtained from the public file in the Denver smuggling case. The Denver file contains extensive information about Sanchez's work as an informant. Sanchez has been under full-time federal protection since he began cooperating in the Noriega and Denver cases in 1988. The names of his family members have been deleted from court records. Nonetheless, his attorney, Christopher Mancini, said in court that Sanchez faced an unprecedented degree of danger. He compared him to Barry Seal, the drug pilot who was gunned down on the streets of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, after he began providing information to the government on Escobar and Ochoa. Well, of course, as we've looked at in the past, both in our Iran-Contra series, specifically a Radio Free America show number 29, and we came back to it in a big way in the December Surprise 89, the miscellaneous archive show dealing with the invasion of Panama, Barry Seal was not only a key player himself in the CIA's Contra-related drug smuggling activities, but also his plane, the one he had used, was the plane that Eugene Hassenfuss was shot down in to kick off the entire Iran-Contra scandal to begin with. Now, again, I don't know what the Denver case is, and quite clearly this case is wrapped in secrecy. I don't know what the Denver case is, but again, the question I'm asking is, what possible relationship is there between the CIA connection to the Silverado savings and loan failure, as yet largely unexplored by the Houston Post? What possible relationship exists between those, and bear in mind that Neil Bush is definitely a director of the Silverado savings and loan, and has not denied approving some of the loans that brought Silverado down. What possible connections are there between the Silverado savings and loan failure and Neil Bush, the Sunflow case with its possibilities of Contra-related drug smuggling activities, the connections to the Bush family there, and this Denver case in which Alfredo Sanchez has played such an important part? Again, I have no hard information linking all of those things, but as I like to say, FFT, GFFR, food for thought, grounds for further research. It'll be interesting to see whether any links between those cases emerge. Now, speaking of Barry Seal, there was an excellent article about Barry Seal, his connections to CIA drug smuggling activities, the Iran-Contra scandal, and so forth, in the July 1989 issue of Penthouse magazine. Now, specifically, this particular article in the July 89 Penthouse was an article called Snowbound. It's about Barry Seal. And Snowbound was co-authored by John Cummings, C-U-M-M-I-N-G-S, and Ernest Volkman, V-O-L-K-M-A-N. And in this particular article, there's a very good account of General Noriega and his involvement with the CIA and with Contra-related drug smuggling activities, and specifically with Operation Eagle, later codenamed Operation Black Eagle. Now, of the involvement of General Noriega and the CIA, Michael Harari, who miraculously escaped the U.S. dragnet in Panama, and in turn, the relationship between these activities and a murdered informant named Hugo Spadafora, who had informed the DEA of Noriega's activities, not realizing that he was doing them for CIA, and in turn, elements in Costa Rica, quite probably connected with U.S. intelligence and quite possibly with the Contra support effort, appear to have tipped off Noriega about Spadafora, thus resulting in his murder. Now, the Spadafora killing, which basically helped to cover up the CIA's connection to Noriega, is what we're going to be looking at in another section of the Peter Dale Scott manuscript shortly. But reading now from Snowbound, Penthouse Magazine's issue of July of 1989, co-authored by John Cummings and Ernest Volkman, this particular section is also included in December Surprise 89. What had started as a trickle was now a flood, overwhelming the relatively puny forces deployed to staunch it. But the flood would get even worse, because the American government was about to go into business with the drug traffickers on a large scale. It began in the mind of then-CIA Director William Casey. As Casey saw the problem, the Soviet Union was about to establish a Central American beachhead via the Sandinista government of Nicaragua. The only solution was to therefore eliminate the Sandinista regime. Since an outright American military invasion was out of the question, beginning in late 1981, Casey began to formulate plans for a covert paramilitary operation to accomplish the task. Essentially, the plan was simple. Two groups of Nicaraguan exiles, one based in Honduras, the other in Costa Rica, would be armed and trained for a guerrilla war inside Nicaragua that would eventually topple the regime. The difficulty, however, was that Congress was extremely nervous about the operation, and amid questions of whether an American-sponsored war was the right way to solve the Nicaraguan problem, there were increasing indications that Congress was about to cut off the money. The first congressional restrictions came in 1982. To prepare for that eventuality, Casey decided on a secret operation to keep the anti-Sandinista forces known as Contras armed and supplied. With a need for strict secrecy in order to circumvent the law, Casey set about creating an operation that could not be traced back to the CIA. Codenamed Eagle, later Black Eagle, the operation went forward through an essential Casey contact, Misha Mike Harare. The former head of operations in Central America for Mossad, Israel's CIA, Harare was a man steeped in the darker arts of modern espionage. Beginning in 1972, he was a key operative for Mossad murder squads that rampaged throughout Europe, killing key Palestinian guerrillas believed to be responsible for the slaughter of Israeli athletes at the 1972 Summer Olympics in Munich. But in 1975, Harare's hit team killed an innocent man in error, and Harare was exiled to Mexico City as chief of Mossad's Central American operations. Harare left the Israeli intelligence service in 1978. In the interim, however, he had not only established close relations with the CIA, he had also forged important business contacts, among them Colonel Noriega of Panama, who had worked closely with Mossad. While serving as a Mossad asset, Harare went into the import-export business in Panama City. The link with his former agency was important. Harare was able to arrange $20 million worth of Israeli arms for Panama's military, plus Mossad training in Israeli-made Uzi submachine guns for Noriega's intelligence operatives. In return, Noriega was able to offer the Israelis the use of Panama, the Vienna of international intrigue in the Southern Hemisphere, as a conduit for embargoed arms to Israel. It was a cozy arrangement, and when Casey sought out Harare in 1982 to help set up a covert contra-support operation, the Israeli knew the perfect point man for the job. Noriega, now a general, the most powerful man in Panama. The choice was unfortunate, for at that point Noriega was a full-fledged drug trafficker, allowing Panama to be used as a narcotics transshipment point. It is questionable whether Harare knew about Noriega's drug connections, but the CIA certainly did. It knew because it had recruited as an information source one of Panama's more striking political leaders, Dr. Hugo Spadafora, Panama's Vice Minister of Health under dictator Omar Torrijos. Following Torrijos' death in a plane crash in 1981, Spadafora at first allied himself with Noriega, then began to get uneasy about the man called Pineapple Face behind his back. The breathtakingly pragmatic Noriega was playing all sides of the street. Spadafora found out that Noriega was being paid $200,000 a year as an asset for the CIA. While at the same time he was providing... The breathtakingly pragmatic Noriega was playing all sides of the street. Spadafora found out that Noriega was being paid $200,000 a year as an asset for the CIA, while at the same time he was providing information to Fidel Castro. Worse, Noriega was deeply involved in drug trafficking, actually allowing Panamanian airstrips to be used in moving drugs to the United States. Actually, the situation was worse than Spadafora knew. As early as 1972, the CIA was aware that Noriega had been named in federal drug enforcement reports as a suspected trafficker, which in 1976 did not prevent then-CIA Director George Bush from approving Noriega's enrollment as a paid CIA asset. In 1977, a report detailing drug dealing by Noriega and other Panamanian military officers was sent to the White House, where it disappeared. Although Bush's successor at the CIA, Stansfield Turner, dropped Noriega from the agency's payroll in 1977 after learning of his drug trafficking, the Panamanian was restored to the agency's good graces when the Reagan administration came into office. Spadafora continued to complain to the CIA about Noriega until the general found out about it in 1985. He had Spadafora tortured to death, then dumped his body in a U.S. mail sack, Noriega's way of making a grisly point. As if the CIA's reliance on a man like Noriega weren't bad enough, the crime was compounded by a second decision. Seal was recruited to find pilots for Black Eagle flights. The requirements were obvious. Prospective pilots had to have some experience smuggling contraband across international borders and had to know how to land loaded planes at remote airstrips and fly at night without lights, among other assorted esoterica not taught at any conventional flying school. There was, of course, only one class of pilots with such experience, and Seal rounded up a collection of the most notorious drug-running pilots in both hemispheres. No one, least of all Seal, had to point out certain benefits of the entirely unofficial arrangement. The pilots would move arms provided by Israel from various sites in the United States and elsewhere down to secret Panamanian airfields. From there, the arms, Russian-made PLO weapons captured by the Israelis whose use would not betray American involvement, would be offloaded for transshipment by various means further south. Instantly grasping that drug pilots would be sitting in cockpits of empty planes for the return flights, Noriega alertly filled the void by arranging for them to carry narcotics. From Noriega's standpoint, the deal was almost too good to be true since he was working both sides of the street. He isn't for sale, but he is for rent, as one CIA official said of Noriega, but that was something of an understatement. Noriega, in fact, was for sale to the highest bidder, and while he was busy helping the CIA, he was also telling the DGI, Castro's intelligence service, about Operation Black Eagle. And to top it all, Noriega actually became an informant for the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. Unbeknownst to the DEA, Noriega used the connection to hand up perceived competitors of his business partners, the Medellin cartel. The head of the DEA later wrote a letter to Noriega praising his contribution to the war against drugs, an embarrassing correspondence he later explained by saying he did not know of Noriega's involvement in drugs because the CIA never told him. That, in turn, raises the question of how much then-Vice President George Bush knew about the operation, especially Noriega's involvement. The evidence is ambiguous, but a central fact is that Casey, concerned that the operation be as far removed from the CIA as possible, hit upon the idea of using the Vice President's office as a cover, arranging it via Bush's chief of staff, Donald Gregg, a former CIA officer. Gregg, in turn, knew the right man to oversee the job. Felix Rodriguez, a fanatically anti-communist Cuban exile who had worked for Gregg and the CIA in Vietnam. In 1981, by then officially retired from the agency, Rodriguez volunteered his services to battle the Sandinistas. Gregg deputized him to oversee the distribution of illegal arms to the Contras, primarily at a staging area in El Salvador, where Rodriguez was good friends with Salvadorian General Juan Bustillo. Both Gregg and Bush were later to say they knew nothing of any illegal operations to arm the Contras until August of 1986, and it is unknown whether Gregg informed his boss of Black Eagle. That, again, by way of reviewing some of the connections between Noriega, the CIA, the Contra support effort, drug smuggling activities on behalf of Contra support effort or tangential and adjacent to it. And again, this is information that one can get from other sources. It has been in considerable measure confirmed from other sources, although you're not likely to see that in a lot of mainstream American publications. Now, bear in mind the betrayal of Hugo Spatafora, who basically did not realize that although Noriega was trafficking in drugs, he did so with official U.S. sanctions. When he reported this to CIA, CIA appears to have relayed the information to people in Costa Rica who got that in turn back to Noriega. And it was basically the CIA through Costa Rica informed Noriega. Returning now to the unpublished manuscript by Peter Dale Scott, The Contra Drug Connection, How North Used Powers from Bush to Prevent Its Disclosure. And still later in this particular manuscript, Peter Dale Scott writes as follows. The Kerry Subcommittee's retreat from the agenda of the original Kerry personal staff memorandum of April 1986 is perhaps best illustrated by the treatment of the Spatafora murder. The original memo, whose author was Jonathan Weiner of Kerry's staff, spoke of the alleged murder of Spatafora, quote, by Contras engaged in drug smuggling in Costa Rica, unquote. The full Kerry subcommittee appears not to have investigated the allegation by the Kerry staff witness, Jack Terrell, that Spatafora was murdered with the collusion of three Contra supporters linked to Frigoríficos de Punta Arenas and the John Hall Ranch, after Spatafora had denounced them along with Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega to DEA agent Roberto Nieves in Costa Rica. That last sentence once again. The full Kerry subcommittee appears not to have investigated the allegation by the Kerry staff witness, Jack Terrell, that Spatafora was murdered with the collusion of three Contra supporters linked to Frigoríficos de Punta Arenas and the John Hall Ranch, after Spatafora had denounced them along with Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega to DEA agent Roberto Nieves in Costa Rica. Now, of course, Frigoríficos de Punta Arenas, that is the Moisés Núñez and Francisco Paco Chanez operation, which in turn appears to link up, certainly the Contra support operations link up with Frank Castro, that in turn appears adjacent to, if not in fact directly connected to, the failure of the People's Savings and Loan in Llano, Texas. Recall the main figure there, Ray Corona. Two big loans, one paid back to the Sunshine State Bank of Corona, one not paid back to Sunshine State Director Harold White. Sunshine State, of course, founded by drug trafficking money, according to Tony Fernandez, an associate of Corona's, one of the unindicted co-conspirators in Tony Fernandez's marijuana smuggling case, Frank Castro, the partner of Paco Chanes and Moises Nunez. The latter two are basically defendants in the Christic Institute suit. Resuming now with Scott's text, Terrell stated that Spatafora's murder came about because Nieves' information was shared with CIA and ultimately with the murderers. Terrell's claim was indirectly corroborated by two of the Kerry Committee witnesses. A Panamanian friend of Spatafora called Floyd Carlton told the committee that Spatafora was arrested and murdered by Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega on the basis of information that came from Costa Rica, though from Costa Rican intelligence, quote-unquote, not the CIA station in Costa Rica. Another witness, Noriega's former consul general Jose Blandon, also said that Spatafora, quote, met with a member of the TICA, Costa Rican intelligence, unquote, and made the mistake of telling him that he would soon denounce Noriega's drug smuggling operations. He also testified that initially Noriega was able to blame the Spatafora killing on the left-wing FMLN of El Salvador thanks to a witness, quote-unquote, who was, quote, obtained through the CIA operating in Costa Rica, unquote. The Terrell story of Contra and Costa Rica's CIA involvement in the Spatafora killing was an allegation of the highest significance. We shall see that Spatafora's death may have been related to changes in the Southern Front command structure and also in the drug traffic. Yet it was not investigated by the full subcommittee, despite its obsession with Noriega. Instead, under the intriguing rubric, U.S. knowledge of Noriega's activities, quote-unquote, the final Kerry report says only, quote, subcommittee witnesses testified that Noriega arranged to have Spatafora tortured and murdered by members of the Panamanian Defense Forces in September of 1985. The possibility that the three Contra supporters were in on the plot is not addressed. We should not be ungrateful for what the Kerry subcommittee investigation did achieve. It has indeed documented through its exhibits the ongoing symbiotic relationship between Contra support activities and drug smuggling to which the original staff memo referred. But as so often happens in Washington, things happened along the way to divert it from areas which the CIA, as well as North, clearly regarded as sensitive. A similar resistance, we should add, obstructed the Iran-Contra investigation, and more importantly, the Christic suit. The final Kerry report's handling or non-handling of the Spatafora allegation is representative of the way it turned its back on the original Kerry staff memorandum and witnesses. Kerry's retreat from the allegations in his original staff memo and report increases the significance of the Christic Institute suit, whose concurrent allegations in this area are now corroborated in many respects by the Kerry exhibits. And in turn, of course, we now see some of the same people implicated in that milieu, the people in and around Frank Chanes, Frank Castro, Moises Nunez. We see some of these same people implicated, or some of the same elements implicated in the murder of Hugo Spatafora. And again, the Frigoríficos de Punta Arenas, the Frank Chanes seafood firm, is important here. Bear in mind, again, the 2-18-90 Houston Post article linking Ray Corona, his Sunshine State Bank, with Tony Fernandez and Frank Castro, whether or not the Sunshine State Bank, the unfortunate late people savings and loan of Llano, Texas, or some of these other SNLs are in fact related to some of these drug smuggling activities. Well, we will find that out presently. We're going to take one more short musical break, and then I'm going to read two more articles by way of foreshadowing what we're going to get into next week when we finish up with the CIA, the SNL, the drug tug, and this intimidating yet fascinating collection of connections, I guess you could say, that we're dealing with this evening.